Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What have humans done to the planet that can never be undone? And how much worse will the damage get as our numbers grow? As of today, global population is at 7.1 billion and counting. And by the end of this century, projections are there could be 3 billion more of us, creating ever greater demand for water, fuel, energy, and other natural resources. So what do experts predict that will mean for the health of the planet and the millions of other species that live here? Stephen Emmett is head of computational science at Microsoft Research and professor of computational science at Oxford University. His new book is called 10 Billion. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much.
This will probably come as no surprise to people given the subject matter, but this is a rather depressing book. On occasion, people will take these facts and try to sort of couch them in hope. What made you decide to just put these out there without a lot of effort to make this information, frankly, more palatable?
Well, I'm not sure that I would say that it was deliberately depressing, and I don't find it depressing. It was more, I find it alarming, and it was more an attempt, in some sense, to as a sort of a wake-up call. But more than that, I think I would call it, in some sense, a manifesto against complacency and inaction, which is what we face, or what the situation is at the moment. And so it was an attempt to get us to think about the problems that we're, and by when I say that we're about to face, I mean humanity, and the problems that we collectively are going to face globally at some point this century in ways that we're currently not thinking about them at the moment.
The complacency is sometimes hard to understand, especially in light of, you know, the evidence that continues to mount to demonstrate what is already happening. Do you think people sort of become overwhelmed by the magnitude of what has to be done?
Well, that's a good question. I don't honestly know the answer to that. It seems to me that there are an awful lot of people who are simply not thinking about it rather than overwhelmed by the magnitude of thinking about it. And on the one hand, for example, on the other, there are concerned individuals, and there are a lot of them, who try and do their bit for the planet by, for example, recycling. But the scale and the nature of the problems that we see, that we are set to face, are completely on an order of magnitude that recycling your newspapers, for example, or using a little bit less water is simply not really going to tackle. And so, I think there might be a sense of what indeed can we do, and that's a good question, and I think that's one for a much more prominent debate about the problems that we face and the systems that we've constructed to live the way we live than we're having today, for example.
This is really astonishing. 10,000 years ago, it appears there were only about a million humans throughout the entire world. Talk about some of the ways that we were able to increase our numbers so rapidly.
Well, one of the primary reasons that enabled us to grow pretty rapidly was the invention of agriculture, and of course that's been tremendously successful in enabling us to continue to feed more and more people. And I suppose what many would call the crowning sort of pinnacle of the agricultural achievement is the so-called Green Revolution, which began in the 1950s and really took hold in the 1960s. And we're still, in some sense, and I use this term carefully, but we're still in some sense benefiting from that because we're producing enough food for many of us to survive. The interesting thing about the Green Revolution is that it has obviously come at some cost in terms of loss of habitat for many other species as a consequence of land use change for agriculture and in deforestation. And it may well be the case that the Green Revolution may even begin to cause problems for us long in the longer term over this century as a consequence of land degradation, increasing resistance of various pathogens to various herbicides and fungicides, and in particular fungicides. So we don't know whether the Green Revolution is likely to be able to continue. And, you know, optimists in this world are keen to point out to me that when I say that we're heading for a food crisis, it's nonsense, because don't I know that there's been this Green Revolution and yield has been as consistently increased since the 1960s. And there are very good reasons for questioning whether that can continue, as I mentioned. For example, if we were to, it's predicted that demand for food will double by 2050. And doubling agricultural productivity is simply not that simple on the current Green Revolution, despite what optimists will say. And it's not going to be that easy to double agricultural productivity in the next 40 years, simply because we already use about 80% of all available fresh water on Earth for agriculture, and there isn't another. We can't double that to produce agriculture. We're beginning to see significant land degradation in many parts of the world. We're beginning to see severe water stress in any case, let alone in doubling water use for agriculture through the rapid depletion of groundwater, which is principally used for irrigation. And of course, climate change is going to have a potentially quite dramatic impact on agricultural productivity, not just because of the global average temperature increase, but also because, in particular, because of the extreme weather events that will come with an increase in global average temperature, in terms of droughts, heat waves, and floods. So I think this notion that we can continue with the Green Revolution and not have to worry about doubling agricultural productivity, which many people seem to think we don't need to worry, is a bit of a fantasy.
If we are not at double the population at 2050, talk about why we could predictably need twice as much food then as now.
Oh, that's a jolly good question. Yes, sorry, I should probably have made that clear. And it's simply because as more of us start to get out of the poverty trap in countries such as India and China and in other parts of Southeast Asia and the Near East and in South America, we tend to consume more food, more calories per day, and in particular more meat. And of course, the meat requires feeding itself before it's turned into meat, and so all of that accounts for a need for a doubling of agricultural productivity, agricultural production, or a doubling of demand for food in general, despite the fact that the population will only have grown from 7 billion to something like nine and a bit billion by 2050.
The water issue is really interesting because it seems like we have problems in both directions, right? We have droughts and floods caused by climate change. And on the other hand, we have rising sea levels. So we have a lot more salt water and a lot less fresh water, ultimately, despite this water cycle that we all learned about in second grade.
Right. I mean, it's interesting. We do learn about the water cycle, but it turns out that the hydrological cycle is an immensely complex system, and there are many parts of it that we don't really fully understand at the moment. For example, I mentioned that groundwater is being depleted in many parts of the world, and that's quite strange because the amount of water that's available to replenish groundwater should be enough, and it simply isn't. And you know, the reasons for that are not entirely fully understood. But it's starting to cause a major problem, and that problem is simply going to get worse as we continue to grow and require more water and more food.
And we should point out that the Green Revolution did develop a lot of crops that are dependent on supplemental irrigation in ways that subsistence farming, although the yields were much lower, did not.
Right, precisely. I mean, as I said, the Green Revolution is hailed as this triumph of human technological achievement and one that we will do again in some way. You know, the rational optimists of the world say, you know, look at the Green Revolution and look at the people like Malthus who said that we're heading for a population problem. And they always cite the Green Revolution. But the Green Revolution has already come at a significant cost, as you've pointed out and as I mentioned earlier, in terms of the use of water for irrigation, which has absolutely gone through the roof since the 1960s with already some consequence. But we also had to breed particular crop types to be, you know, in terms of, we bred out crops natural resistance to pests because crops natural resistance to pests inhibits their rate of growth, and we need crops to grow quickly. We bred out crops natural resistance to a range of other pathogens, and that may now come back to bite us. And we had to compensate for all of those things through a massive use of pesticides, herbicides, and of course, we had to breed crops that relied heavily on artificial fertilizer to increase yield.
Some of which, those artificial fertilizers, are finite resources.
That's right. I mean, they're all based upon a rock called phosphate. And it may well be the case that we're heading for a phosphate crisis. And again, what's interesting is that there are many people who are keen to quickly point out that there is apparently 300 years of phosphate left. And that's an actual misleading statement. And I certainly wish it were true, but it's almost certainly not true. And the reason is because up until recently, there was thought to be about 15 billion tons of phosphate reserves left, and the vast majority of that in Morocco. And the U.S. Geological Survey recently revised its figures for phosphate reserves up to something like between 60 and 70 billion tons, which in simple terms would mean that actually there was 300 years of phosphate reserves left if we just on the current rate of phosphate consumption. Now, there's two problems with this statement. And by the way, the US Geological Survey, which is a highly respected organization, simply collects those statistics from governments and businesses. So it just compiles what governments and businesses tell it its reserves are. Hmm. And it turns out there are a number of countries that have simply just upped their estimations of their own reserves for a number of reasons. And so we've now got this new figure of 62 to 70 billion tons of phosphate reserves left. But what that doesn't really take into account, if you say, well, that's 300 years, is that the use of phosphate for turning to fertilizer is destined to increase because we need to produce more food. So that's one issue that would not make it to 300 years. And the other one is it doesn't take into account how much of that phosphate is feasibly mineable, and we don't really know how much of it is mineable, but it certainly won't be all 60 to 70 billion tons. And then the third reasons why there is good reason to doubt some of these rational optimists when it comes to phosphates as well, is that we don't know how much of it is contaminated with cadmium, for example, but what we do know is it's likely to be a significant amount. Now, if one takes all of those into account, one should take a prudent view that we may well run out of phosphate this century, and that would be a massive problem for us.
Stephen Emmett let me jump in. We have to take a quick break here. My
sure.
guest is Stephen Emmett. His new book is called 10 Billion. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Stephen Emmett. He is head of computational science at Microsoft Research and professor of computational science at Oxford University. His new book is called 10 Billion. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. And Stephen, just before the break, you were telling us why it would be prudent to take a conservative view on estimates of phosphate reserves.
Yes. As I mentioned, it's because, you know, this rational optimist view that this apparent new estimate of a massive new estimate revised up of 60 to 70 billion tons or so of global phosphate reserves may not turn out to be as optimistic as it initially seems for those as we would like, simply because either it's not feasible to mine or it might be contaminated with cadmium. And we don't actually know how reliable that new estimate is anyway.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Charlie in Highland Village. Hello, Charlie. Hi, Charlie. Are you with us?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
This does sound like a very pessimistic book, and I'm an incurable optimist. But look at some of the reasons for my optimism. During my lifetime, we've been 10 years away from running out of petroleum every year, and yet we've somehow discovered how to solve that problem.
Well, that's actually something. Thank you so much for your call, Charlie. Stephen, you don't think we're in danger of running out of petroleum in the near future. You're more concerned that we will continue burning it.
Yes. We're always discovering, as the caller said, new reserves of oil, coal, and gas, and in terms of peak energy, whether peak oil is about to occur or has occurred, is a potentially is a debatable issue. But peak energy, we certainly haven't reached, and of now, of course, in the U.S. we have this, a so-called game-changing energy revolution, which is shale oil and gas, and it looks as though my own country is about to go and try and create the same game-changing energy revolution, which is strange for a country that claims it's committed to having a very low carbon footprint by 2020 and 2050. I think it would be, my concern is continuing to burn fossil fuels, not running out of them. Mm-hmm. I think that we're set to do that. Clearly, there are some efforts underway to develop green technologies, green energy technologies in terms of wind and solar and hydro, where hydro geologically is possible. But even the U.S. Energy Information Authority and the UK government all predict that the predominant use, source of energy production to 2050 and almost certainly to 2100 will be fossil fuels, and that's going to cause us enormous problems, because the simple fact is we cannot deny that if we continue to put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, that the climate is going to change. I mean, it's a simple fact of physics that was demonstrated by John Tyndall in the 1850s, and no matter how much we want to deny climate change, we can't deny the laws of physics, and that's a reliable one.
Explain for us what the global carbon cycle is, and why it's functioning differently now than it has historically.
Well, it's an interesting question that the. It is worth putting into context that human burning of fossil fuels produces about 8 gigatons of carbon, so 8 billion tons of carbon every year. But there's this enormous process that is critical to governing and regulating the climate, called the global carbon cycle. And the global carbon cycle processes over 200 gigatons compared to our 8 every year. And yet we're currently modifying every aspect and every component of the global carbon cycle. So, for example, as I mentioned in the book, right now, every leaf on every tree on Earth is experiencing a level of carbon dioxide that's not been witnessed on this planet for probably 5 million years. And how the planet's plants, which are a massive component of the global carbon cycle, are going to respond to that, we don't know. But it's a fundamental and profound modification of the a key component of the global carbon cycle. So the global carbon cycle is basically broken down into what's called a terrestrial carbon cycle and the ocean carbon cycle. And terrestrial carbon cycle is principally all the planets and plants, and of course, notably, it's trees. In addition to the modification of the global the terrestrial carbon cycle through elevated CO2, of course, we're modifying the terrestrial carbon cycle in another way, which is deforestation. And if we continue to deforestation on the rate that we're currently deforesting, that too is set to continue to have a pretty significant impact on how the global carbon cycle works. And it is critical to point out that the global carbon cycle is absolutely fundamental to regulating the climate that we require to survive on this planet. And it's quite alarming and quite incredible that we're modifying every component of it right now.
Many people have looked at the idea of truly calculating the cost of our consumption of goods, our consumption of energy, and building that back into the price. I suppose, you know, when we talk about the resistance to that, the problem is we began this kind of consumption before we understood what we were doing, and so it feels like we're being charged extra for something we've already bought. Does that make sense?
If I understand, and stop me if I've misunderstood your question correctly, but if I think one of the problems that we fail to tackle is that the production of just about everything that we consume comes with some pretty significant what are called externalities, so external costs that no one is paying for, certainly we're not paying for, and businesses that produce those things also don't pay for, but which someone is going to have to, but their costs nevertheless, and someone is going to have to pay for them at some point, and it's probably going to be our children or grandchildren. And, you know, whether people care about that is, I suppose, an interesting one topic for discussion. But these sorts of costs are going to have to be paid for. And, you know, for example, the cost of making a car, the cost of buying a car has no reflection upon the external costs in the production of a car in terms of pollution, environmental degradation, loss of ecosystems through pollution and those sorts of things. And of course, CO2 emissions from cars and mining, for example, for the metals for the components for the car and all of those things. And yet those externalities, as they're called, those external costs, are costs. So as I say, they're going to have to pay for it at some point.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the phone to Austin in Fort Worth. Hi, Austin.
Hi there. I had a question. I was curious as to why we've continued for so long to use fossil fuels and things that, you know, deplete our energy, our planet's resources, instead of moving to, as you said before, solar or wind power, or even, I think there are hydrogen-powered engines where you almost simply put water in and it produces oxygen out of the air instead of harmful elements.
Well, it's an interesting question, is the notion of hydrogen cars. And why we continue to use fossil fuels at all. I think it's because we do need to power the planet, and I think, you know, whilst and so the question arises, how do we do that? And the cheapest way to do that, of course, is to continue to use fossil fuels. And we have up until some of these issues to do with environmental change have become much more visible in the public amongst many more people. In the developed world, people have not wanted to pay more for their energy. So it's been much easier for governments and businesses to continue to advocate and produce fossil fuels, and they still are doing, and produce, you know, quote, cheap, unquote, energy. Even though there are, even with energy production, as I mentioned earlier, there are these enormous external costs from energy production that we're simply not paying, don't have to pay for at the minute, but someone's going to have to. And but even now, when we all know, the interesting thing is, even now when we all know that the use of fossil fuels is dangerous, we seem perfectly happy to want to continue to do so, so long as there is some sort of remote effort that makes us feel better, that the government or businesses are sort of doing something, quote unquote, around green technologies and trying to go to a so-called low-carbon economy. You know, there are some powerful vested interests at play there, amongst both with governments and influence on governments from the energy companies. In terms of hydrogen-powered cars, a brilliant idea. Absolutely agree with you. Hydrogen-powered cars, a brilliant idea. The issue with hydrogen cars, and indeed in some sense electric cars, although it's not as good an idea, it turns out, as hydrogen cars, is that we would then need to start really intensively mining all of the things to produce hydrogen-powered cars, unless we somehow found a way to just convert every engine that's currently a petrol engine or a diesel engine to take the engine out and just put a hydrogen-powered engine in. And, maybe that's possible, in which case maybe hydrogen-powered cars might be a solution. But I see little effort in terms of a move towards hydrogen-powered cars. And, of course, there are some hydrogen-powered buses. But it's a good question, the topic of, of why we're not doing this, some of these things.
You write that, I never thought I'd say this, that's a direct quote, but nuclear power would seem to be the only existing technology that might solve the energy problem, at least in the short term, that is for the next few decades. But for nuclear power to be a solution, we would need to be embarking on a global nuclear power program right now, and we're not.
Right. Well, I mean, that's just an observation. It's not an opinion. So, I mean, I'm not trying to make the claim that no government on Earth is expanding its nuclear power capability, and indeed there are several countries, France for one, which almost entirely relies on nuclear power. But it is the case that voters typically, not all voters, but voters in many countries tend not to like nuclear power, and so politicians tend to shy away from nuclear power programs as a replacement, or at least accelerating existing nuclear power programs. So, of course, in the UK there's a nuclear power program, but expanding that significantly is not one that voters like. Comes under immense opposition, and it's not one that governments are terribly keen, or at least government in the UK, and there are many others, to want to pursue, other than paying lip service to these things, because it makes politicians unelectable in many parts of the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Stephen in Grapevine. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning. Dr.
Emmett.
Is it?
Stephen. Stephen is fine.
My name is Stephen, too. I read a book back in the 1960s called The Population Bomb. It was written by a biology professor at Stanford, and he made
Paul
a lot
Ehrlich.
Of predictions.
Paul Ehrlich.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. And he made a lot of predictions, which people kind of poo-pooed because of the Green Revolution is becoming so successful then. But was his timing off, or were his predictions still pretty, and there were others that during the same time. Are those beginning to show up more viable now, or more likely?
Well, I mean, that's a very good question. And, of course, some of his timings were off. But it's an interesting point that when I talk about some of these topics, people who are quick to criticize this issue about the consequences of growth of us always cite Ehrlich as actually getting it completely wrong. But that misses two points. One is, does that mean to say that we're not in trouble now? You know, Paul Ulrich made that point when there were something like 3 and a bit billion of us, and there are now 7, and we're well on our, you know, we're definitely on our way to 10, and it could be more. And so even if one were to say Paul Ulrich was completely wrong, I don't mean to say that things are absolutely fine now and we have absolutely nothing to worry about. And second is, I don't want to speak for Paul Ulrich, but he would probably say himself, you know, we miss in completely dismissing some of the things that he predicted in the book, we completely miss the point that there are well over a billion people on Earth right now who have who live in conditions of severe water shortage, who are malnourished, and have too little, far too little food, energy, and water, and to ignore those people simply because we people like you and I live in rich countries. And don't have those problems, at least yet, is to really miss the point of what Ulrich, the core of Ulrich's thesis. And of course, some of the details he got wrong, but to dismiss the entire thesis was a mistake, I think.
Inevitably, Stephen, when we have a conversation like this, someone will call and say, well, the solution is to stop human reproduction, to just quit having children. You say that that just doesn't make sense based on every sort of instinct that is programmed into us by nature.
Well, I think what I actually say is, yes, reducing fertility rate is absolutely critical as part of behavior change. What I say is that it's not clear to me whether that's going to happen. Now, of course, fertility rates globally have fallen steadily since the 1960s. And yet, even at the current fertility rate, which is beginning to, I'm talking about global fertility rate,
right,
which is beginning to level off, you know, this continuing trend of a reduction in global fertility rates, which once again, you know, the rational optimists, as they characterize themselves, I might want to not quite characterize them in that sense, but that the term for these people who say we have nothing to worry about is the rational optimist.
You know, I'm sorry to jump in once again, but we're taking another quick break. I definitely want you to have time to finish this thought. My guest is Stephen Emmett. He is head of computational science at Microsoft Research and professor of computational science at Oxford. His new book is called 10 Billion. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Creative Writing, and Organizational Dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Stephen Emmett. He is head of a multidisciplinary scientific research team at Microsoft, and he's professor of computational science at Oxford University. He has a new book out called 10 Billion. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. And before the break, Stephen, you were talking about population projections and how fertility rates might affect those.
Yes. As I was saying, there are many who have a more optimistic view about this century than I, who say we really don't have a population problem because population is likely to peak at 9, possibly 10 billion, and will decline because of ongoing decline in global fertility rates, which started in the 1960s and still continues today. And you know, and of course, I do recognize that fertility rates have fallen and are falling. However, the claim that is simply going to be the extrapolation, and it is simply an extrapolation, that is going to continue for the remainder of this century, and that we may even have an underpopulation problem by the end of the century, is really a stretch too far, really, because it is a simple extrapolation. Already we can see that this declining global fertility rate, birth per woman, is starting to level off, and it is worth pointing out that even on the current fertility rate that's been dropping since the 1960s, if the current fertility rate were to continue as I say, is starting to level off. There wouldn't be 10 billion of us at the end of this century. There would be 28 billion of us, according to UN projections. Even I don't think there would be 28 billion of us by the end of this century. But it is worth pointing out that the projection of even 10 billion, and by the way, the projection of 10 billion came from the UN recent population projections for the end of the century. And since the book has been published, they've revised that number upwards to almost 11 billion. And they do point out in the revised projections that on what's called the constant fertility variant, which is the current rate of reproduction of women globally, if that were to continue, there would be 28 billion people on Earth. And that would certainly cause us problems.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the phone, we have Dazarad in Irving. Hi, Dazarad.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is actually about our ability to solve this crisis. For example, water is a finite resource, and it's a common good, right? Nobody owns it. How serious are these governmental organizations in solving it at a global scale, even at a micro level? For example, state of Texas and state of Oklahoma are duking it out over water. On a global scale, how serious are these governing bodies to solve this global crisis? It's a tragedy of commons at the end of the day, right? Nobody wants to give up.
Well, I mean, you raise a number of interesting points there, actually, about I wish it were the case that no one owned water. But in fact, water is actually a big business in many, if not most parts of the world. And it's not the case, and yet water does have a common is a common basic requirement for life, and water is being depleted at quite some rate in many parts of the countries, and particularly interestingly, water depletion. I'm talking about fresh water, and particularly groundwater depletion, which we require for both, certainly for irrigation. But also for drinking in many parts of the world as well, in addition to surface water, is occurring in many parts of the world where population is growing fastest, and therefore demand for food is growing fastest. So there's this double problem of increasing water scarcity in places where more water is needed most. But it's not just in developing countries, especially in India and China, where there's a water problem. But there's an increasing water problem in the U.S., for example, and in parts of Europe, as a consequence of the depletion of aquifers or groundwater systems, again, principally for agriculture. And agricultural productivity is going to have to increase in the United States as well. You raise a second point, which was related to that, and it's a very good one, which was about global governance of such systems. And the fact of the matter is that we cannot escape, it's difficult to escape the conclusion, on the basis of evidence that we have to date, that governments worldwide have completely failed us in terms of getting on really getting to terms with actually doing something about the problem. Now, on the one hand, we can't completely blame governments for just leave it to them, but there is a need. For a totally, a really urgent need for governments worldwide to really get on top of this problem in terms of global governance, and it simply isn't happening. I mean, you look at all of these G20 meetings and all of these UN, what's called COP meetings, these Conference of Parties meetings at Doha and Brazil, and the Rio Plus 20 conference in Brazil that happened. A little while ago, and all that comes out of them is words and inaction. And all we've had for 30 years, even though governments worldwide have known about these problems, is words and inaction. And you look at what comes out of these conventions now and these governmental meetings, and we absolutely look set for another 30 years of words and inaction. And that is going to cause us a massive problem.
Stephen, what stands in the way of large-scale desalination projects around the world?
Well, it's interesting because although the previous caller quite rightly pointed out, as we discussed before, there's an emerging water problem. We could potentially solve the water problem through desalination and plants, and indeed, you know, there are some parts of the world, particularly in the Middle East, that have recognized this some time ago for some obvious reasons in the Middle East, in terms of water scarcity, and are building some pretty substantial desalination programs. But the issue with desalination is that to solve the water problem globally, we would need to be embarking on a massive desalination program right now, and we're not. And secondly, even if we did embark on such a massive program, which we aren't, we would be potentially solving the water problem, but exacerbating two others. One is the energy problem, because desalination is incredibly energy intensive. And it's, you know, again, the so-called rational optimists would say, well, actually, you know, that desalination technology will be transformed in 50 years and it will be far less energy intensive, but that remains to be seen. So it would be exacerbating the energy problem we have looming as well, and also almost certainly exacerbating a problem with ecosystem degradation. Especially marine ecosystem degradation around coastal areas, which hundreds of millions of people rely on every day, because desalination is extremely polluting. So yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next, we have Manfred on the line in Dallas. Hi, Manfred.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm glad that you finally tackled this issue, and I've been, but I'm kind of optimistic about the future. By the way, I have only one child, and that was a conscious decision between me and my wife.
Right.
And the thing is that politically, it's not very popular right now. The leadership is failing us because it's not politically, attractive to discuss it, because people don't have any interest in it, because it's such a long term, and they'd rather fix the short term problems rather than do the long term. And I grew up in the Philippines, and also the problem, it's a third world country, and the problem there also is that still now families have lots of children because of economic, because they contribute to the economic wealth of the family. They use the resources. They're really minimal, maximized use of resources in third world countries, but still the degradation of the environment is pretty bad.
Well,
I'm not very optimistic about it.
You put a lot on the table there, so let's get a response for you. Thanks for your call.
Yes, thank you. Yes, I mean, I would share many of the same concerns and sentiments for all the reasons that the chap set out quite well, I thought. And again, I think it's worth one sort of data point for challenging some of these, you know, rational optimist assumptions. I've used this term so often, by the way. I should explain what it means. So the rational optimists are people who say, yes, we're in trouble, but we don't really need to worry because we're so clever, and we've demonstrated at every point in human history that we're so clever and we're so ingenious and so adaptive that at every time there's been a problem, we've technologized or adapted our way out of it, and we will continue to do so. And they, for example, they cite the Green Revolution as an example, and the Industrial Revolution, and the, you know, and the Agricultural Revolution in general. And what that misses the point of, the other aspect of the rational optimist argument is, in this occasion, we don't really need to worry about there being a population problem because, you know, can't you see that fertility rates have been declining since the 1960s? And again, the problem with both of those arguments, in terms of, that's why they call themselves the rational optimists. And the problem with both of those arguments is that it fails to recognise that we've technologized our way into these problems in the first place. And the notion that we're just going to somehow, no one really sort of knows how, unless we sort of, you know, there isn't any real technological fix that's obvious here, but somehow we will technologize our way out of this, is an extrapolation that simply doesn't hold much water. And the second thing is this notion about we don't have a population, we don't really need to worry about population because of this declining fertility rate is also a simple extrapolation that we simply do not know whether it will continue. And so my own personal view is right now, like your caller, we have good grounds for being rational pessimists rather than rational optimists.
Well, what's interesting about this idea that, you know, someone will solve it or we will solve it, typically people who are saying that are not the ones actively engaged in trying to solve these problems.
that is a remarkably clever point, if I should say, and few people really pick up on that. And it does make people quite cross when I mention this, is that many of these rational optimists are not actually doing anything about it. They just assume that others are going to do something about it. And so, yes, you make a remarkably insightful observation there.
Well, thank you. So as you, I mean, you know, you're still living in the UK. I'm assuming that you live a, you know, middle-class lifestyle or better. Can you talk about how investigating all of this has affected the way you look at your role in the world and the way that you conduct just your everyday personal life?
That's a good question. I don't know how many middle-class lifestyles include, by the way, a leaking roof, no central heating, and half the electrics in the house not working properly. But,
I'm sorry to hear that. You've got a good job, anyway.
but I do have, a good job. How has it affected my own life? Well, I don't consume much. I have to say, I don't have a TV. I don't really buy many clothes, as if you could see me, it would be immediately obvious. It is true I have quite a lot of books, but I don't have lots of gadgets like iPads and whatnot. So I'm not a big consumer of things. Whilst I'm not a vegetarian, I don't eat a lot of meat. I think, more broadly, how has it made me think? Well, I don't have any children, which are probably the biggest carbon emitters eventually
right.
That one can really acquire. But I don't know whether that's the nature of your question. It has the work that I do in my lab, which you know. Spans a broad range of scientific domains, but a large proportion of it does underpin many of the issues that I chose to tackle in the book. I think one of the most profound things is doing the kind of modelling that we do in my lab, whether it's modelling climate or modelling ecosystems.
And we have just a few seconds left, and I'm sorry to speed you up.
Not at all. I've really made me realise that there is a need to sound an alarm and get us to think about the problems that we face in a way that we're currently not thinking about them.
Stephen Emmett's new book is called 10 Billion. Stephen, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
Not at all. Thanks for inviting me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast at kera.org/think. And we welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.